time once again for our community forum, and we're very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Timothy Harris. Timothy Harris is executive director of Real Change News, a local homeless newspaper here in Seattle. Tim, thanks very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
I'm very happy to be here.
Start out, tell us about Real Change News. Did I describe that right?
Mm-hmm. Real Change has been around for 15 years now. I founded it in 94, moved here from Boston to start the paper. Started a paper previous to that in Boston in 92 called Spare Change, which was the same sort of a paper, but organized so that homeless people were putting the entire thing out and running it. And I moved here to start another paper on a sort of a more stable model. It's grown from a single staff organization with virtually no budget to a weekly newspaper that prints 18 to 20,000 copies a week, that is sold by an average of around 400 vendors a month that are out there on the street selling the paper. They buy it for 35 cents. They sell it for the cover price of a dollar on average. They put about a buck and a quarter in their pocket for every paper they sell. We broke, I think last year our total circulation was like 840,000, which means that we directly put about $1 million into the pockets of poor and homeless people last year. And then we're an organizing project as well, which is really kind of the heart and soul of what we do. We're not just about putting people to work and creating opportunity. We're about creating structural change by using the newspaper as a medium for organizing and involving poor and homeless people in the fight.
So talk about that more, the organizing structure and how Real Change vendors are getting more than just, you know, money out of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that was a big piece of the inspiration for starting the paper was, you know, how to resolve the contradiction of fighting for social change being something that involves a real long timeline and horizon and is an uncertain prospect. And reconciling that with the value of poor and homeless people needing to be involved, you know, directly in the fight, and being part of that change, and also having very immediate dire needs to be met. And the problem of how do you meet those immediate needs while involving them in the long range struggle for social change. And the street newspaper was a really great way to kind of pull that contradiction together and make it work. And it also, you know, reaches a broad audience, you know, so it's kind of a bridge between the haves and the have-nots. Our reader demographic is actually, you know, largely people that are over 45, educated liberals. It's a fairly affluent demographic. It's a very educated demographic. You know, it's people who are sympathetic, but, you know, not necessarily connected personally to the struggles of poor people. And it's a really great way of kind of bridging constituencies across class and bringing folks into mutual action. And that's really the core principle of our organizing project is, you know, operating in a relationship-based way that leverages what's, you know, really our greatest asset is the paper, those relationships that get built on the street between vendors and readers. And doing that work, that organizing in a cross-class way that involves people, you know, across class and builds relationships on around that.
How does one become a Real Change vendor?
It's pretty easy, you know. I mean, we are very intentionally a low-threshold project, you know. There's lots of employment, well, there's not enough of them, but there are other employment projects out there, but they require things like 6 months sobriety and, you know, a commitment to regular weekly participation and things of that nature. And with us, you know, we just have an orientation a couple of times a week that takes about an hour. And you need to come to that orientation. And, you know, we go over the code of conduct, how to successfully sell the newspaper, an overview of what we're about and what the expectations are. And at the end of it, they get their first 10 papers for free. They get their vendor badge, and they are a vendor. They're out on the street selling the paper. They sell their first 10 papers. They got 10 bucks in their pocket. They can come back and put $3.50 of that into 10 more papers, and they're off to the races. So, you know, we're really about offering opportunity to people who otherwise would often have none.
And then how is content within the paper selected?
Mm-hmm. We look at ourselves as being, we define ourselves as being a broadly progressive community newspaper, and we're really quite clear on that, that we're not, you know, the homelessness newspaper. We certainly cover issues around homelessness, poverty, class inequality. I mean, those are core interests, but we write very broadly. We have high values in terms of the quality of our journalism. We have a paid staff that has 3 reporters, a broad range of volunteers that have a lot of reporting experience. It's a real quality newspaper, and that very much surprises people because they expect something different a lot of the time. They expect, you know, we actually did a focus group about 5 years ago, and our core learning from that is that we have this sort of built-in branding problem. You know, people assume homeless newspaper equals produced by and for homeless people, equals piece of crap that the only reason I would buy it is out of charity, so I give the person a dollar and then I throw it on the car floor and ignore it because it's basically for recycling. And it really took us quite a bit of effort to intentionally address that and start to turn it around. And it's a perception that we'll always be wrestling with, but that we'll always be countering at the same time.
Yeah, I've often been pleasantly surprised by regularly cross paths with one of your vendors, and we purchase a paper every week. But how often stories and or interviews people you have in the paper are people that have, for instance, also been on this show.
Yeah.
Get to see a much more in-depth interview in your paper.
Well, I mean, that's one of the great things about being in Seattle, is we're one of those crossroads cities where a lot of really interesting people come through, and, you know, we're a paper that's developed a reputation, and, you know, one of the real strong points of the paper is the centerfold interview and, you know, the people that we've had in that. You know, we've been very, very fortunate there.
So, talk, you've been doing this for a long time, both here in Seattle and elsewhere. Talk about what you see as critical issues that we're facing right now that aren't being addressed in the corporate media.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, when you think about homelessness, homelessness is so vastly misunderstood, and that's not accidental. There is a... The typical framing of homelessness is that this is a social services issue that is all about screwed up people, screwed up individuals who are failing because of poor life choices, and really steers folks away from understanding that homelessness is a policy choice, that it's the direct product of a deeply and badly broken system of 30 plus years of increasing inequality, and what that means in terms of policy choices and decisions, and homelessness fundamentally being about surplus people in a post-global age and an increasing trend toward writing off surplus people and throwing them to the wolves and pretending that we are meaningfully addressing this problem through a bunch of feel-good strategies that ultimately don't amount to much in terms of structural change. So that's what we're up against. And there is huge mystification of the issue that really, you know, is geared to neutralize it as a political issue and to sort of sidestep and neutralize that outrage that people naturally feel when, you know, they're stepping over people on the sidewalk and wondering, you know, what is it about our system that produces this kind of desperation and poverty? And instead of being, you know, that channeled into meaningful social change activity, that gets channeled into a kind of a charitable impulse and reduced to looking at it individually instead of structurally.
So go into more about how how our society neutralizes people's impulse to try and address this.
Well, I mean, the primary example is the 10-year plan to end homelessness, you know, which is the paradigm, you know, across the United States. There are more than 800 cities that have adopted 10-year plans to end homelessness. This came out of the Bush administration. You know, I teach a class on homelessness, and one of the things that I say to my students is, you know, and I kind of open up the class with this and sort of set the tone for it. I say, think of this as a Zen koan. Why would, you know, President Bush, perhaps the most hostile president to the interests of homeless people and poor people since, you know, since Hoover, why would this president declare himself to be the president that is going to end homelessness and establish, you know, the federal apparatus of the 10-year plan to end homelessness? And it's like a Cohen, you know, it's an absurdity, like, you know, the sound of one hand clapping. If you think about it long enough, you'll like break through to enlightenment and understand, you know, what this is really about. And, you know, the answer to that is that it is a paradigm that is about framing. It is about neutralizing. And it's built on a kind of a worshiping of objective data and a kind of a micro burrowing into subpopulations that takes you way deep internally into a very individualized way of looking at it as opposed to a systemic way of looking at it, and isolating of the problem geographically and intellectually from the broader issues, and a sort of like warm, reassuring idea that this is a problem that we're taking care of. You know, homelessness is being meaningfully addressed. A distortion of the data to show that the numbers are going down when in fact the opposite is true. If government is on the horns of dilemma, government is the wrong actor to end homelessness, you know, and it's interesting because they cannot ignore homelessness. To ignore the issue of homelessness is to appear illegitimate and unjust. But at the same time, they can't meaningfully address it, because to do that would be to address all of those sort of vexing labor issues and wage issues and supply and demand issues that are sort of at the core of neoliberalism and globalization. So they're not going to do that either. So what they have to do is pretend to address the issue, to assuage the consciences of the sort of, you know, politically aware middle class. And, you know, what I often say is that it's like a fat guy running, you know. I mean, there's a lot of visible effort. You see a lot of huffing and puffing and sweat going on, but there isn't much progress there at all.
It's interesting. I had no idea that it was this 10-year plan was happening in so many other cities, and it reminds me of the issue of when we were dealing with the stadiums here locally, and had one known that there were 30 other cities that were also wrestling with, should we spend billions of dollars on these, you know, palaces, how empowering that would have been to those who were resisting that.
Well, yeah, you know, and that's the thing that is, you know, important to understand, is that there is a broad national context to homelessness, and the same thing that's happening here is happening everywhere else. You know, Seattle is the global city with broadening inequality paradigm, you know. I mean, it's what's happening everywhere else, but on steroids. You know, cities are being reinvented, have been reinvented in the post-global age as places for the affluent to choose the urban lifestyle. And they are becoming these sort of islands of affluence in a growing sea of inequality and increasing poverty. And, you know, so what you see is, like in Seattle, where you've got the downtown condo boom and the implications of for gentrification and property values and affordability and the loss of affordable housing. But at the same time, you've got the other end of the pole of increasing inequality, which is, you know, destitution, the people on the bottom who have just been, you know, written off and are surplus to the economy, the people that don't have the skills to compete, the people who have had lousy educations, the black underclass that have been incarcerated. 1 in 99 Americans are now behind bars. It's another aspect of the same issue, the marginalization and containment of the surplus underclass. You know, it's all right there, and what goes along with it is a criminalization of that underclass, of the visibly poor, that is really just about having a whole suite of tools to sweep people under the rug and get them out of sight, because they make the affluent, who are also existing downtown, uncomfortable and nervous. And this has been called strategies of reassurance by one writer. And they include, you know, bans against shopping carts, anti-panhandling legislation, sit-lie ordinances, passing laws that make feeding people in public illegal. In Santa Cruz, it's been illegal to own a blanket. Things like this. And there's a template, you know. I mean, downtown associations, business improvement districts across the nation have adopted exactly the same strategies. The exact same dynamics are going on everywhere. And, you know, what is crazy-making about the 10-year plans is you get this kind of a committee of planners. I sort of think of it as the committee to manage the contradiction, you know, and it's government officials, it's big philanthropy, it is the major players of the nonprofit institutions, the multi-million dollar organizations, and they're the ones that are calling the shots, and they're entirely co-opted, and they are completely silent on all of the related civil rights issues and criminalization issues and the big structural issues. And they've got this sort of micro-focus that, you know, it is simply about producing more affordable housing with services that studiously ignores the broader context and kind of sucks all of the air out of the room for different approaches by kind of labeling themselves as the way and setting the agenda for homeless advocacy. It's a huge problem, and it's a underappreciated one.
So then do large cities become then the primary structure or tool for implementing these policies, or are they just the ground zero where we see this, or both?
It's both. I mean, the large cities are the ground zero where the problem of increasing inequality is most profound, because you have the gentrification that comes along with, you know, the cities becoming the place for the affluent to live, the sort of flipping of the suburban and urban that we've seen in the post-global decade, you know, where instead of the affluent living out in the burbs, they're living in the city, and the burbs are becoming the places where the people who can't live in the city have been driven to. You know, there's been a flipping of that demographic. But at the same time, the urban areas are the places that have the tax base to provide the services to the very poor. So you've got a contradiction there, you know. I mean, the very poor must be in the cities because that's where the services are and that's where the money is to provide the services that they need. So, you know, the whole 10-year plan thing, cities have to have a 10-year plan if they want to get funding around homelessness, because the federal grants, the McKinney-Vento money is on a point system. And if you want a decent chance of getting federal dough around homelessness, you've got to have a 10-year plan, and you've got to have an HMIS data system, which is the sort of computer data system that all of the providers have to be linked into that feeds data to the feds. And, you know, the concern with people when they wanted to implement that, here in Seattle it's called Safe Harbors, the concern was that that data was going to be used in a sort of an invasive privacy, way that would be invasive of privacy, you know, and that it was going to lead to sort of, you know, the microchipping of the homeless or something like that. And that hasn't been a problem at all. What it has done, however, is been a way to set the agenda for service providers and control the sort of paradigm and priorities for service provision around really targeting chronically homeless people or the visibly poor, the visible homeless, the ones who make downtown dwellers most uncomfortable, really targeting the resources there. And what we've seen as a result of that is a sort of a ignoring of family homelessness, of rural homelessness, and really a kind of a abandonment of addressing the deeper structural issues behind it in favor of, you know, kind of mitigating the most unpleasant aspects of visible poverty that make urban dwellers nervous.
So where do you see is the critical place to break or shatter that paradigm that's currently being implemented?
You know, I think that there are several places. One is to question the notion of who's calling the shots in this movement around homelessness. You know, I mean, is it... is it the place of the sort of, you know, big philanthropy and the big institutional service providers and government to have the leadership of the movement around homelessness and poverty? Or should poor people themselves be in the mix there somewhere, you know, and included in that in more than a deeply tokenistic way, which is, you know, certainly the case now. Another is to fully recognize how linked incarceration and homelessness are as two sides of the same coin. You know, the sort of end product of globalization and the creation of a surplus class of people and the need to contain that surplus class, you know, by marginalizing them geographically into, you know, the outer areas and the sort of invisible poverty zones and the shelters, or to incarcerate them. You know, you can look at the explosion of the prison industrial complex and institutional sheltering as an answer to homelessness over the last three decades, and it's exactly the same line. It's exactly the same sort of hockey stick on a graph. And you know, when you look at how uniformly the criminalization of poverty and the civil rights aspects of that has been implemented across the nation, You know, it's a very, very, the civil rights field is a very, very clear and urgent place for people to assert themselves. And the other thing I believe is to really step back and see this as a multi-issue fight. As long as homeless advocates and people who care about homelessness are fixated on homelessness alone, we will never win. We will be isolated and spinning our wheels in a sort of a single issue ghetto. You know, this is connected to needing to break the stranglehold of the military economy. It's connected to fair taxation. It is connected to ending inequality. It is connected to the deep hold of institutional racism and the failure of the civil rights movement to address class as a dynamic in that issue. All of these issues are deeply related, and we can only win when we start doing cross-class, multiracial, multi-issue movement building around the core issue of rising inequality.
You see, focusing on the city program, city policies as a good starting point, given, you know, we have a new mayor, new city prosecutor in?
Yeah, I mean, we're in a really, really interesting moment right now in Seattle, you know. I mean, I think of this last election as being really a populist revolt, you know, where we got Mayor McGinn and we got Dow Constantine and we got Peter Holmes and all of these folks, you know, the mayor, the county executive, the city attorney, they were all very, very clear that they were opposed to the city of Seattle constructing a new jail, which was something that the last mayoral administration was deeply, deeply invested in. They just really sort of staked their flag on that ground. So, you know, the new jail ought to be dead on arrival, but I believe that unless people continue to organize that around that and make sure it happens, that we could still see a new jail in this city, and we shouldn't take that for granted. And that while all of these folks would, you know, like to see the new jail in Seattle go away, unless there continues to be a grassroots push around that, you know, that's going to be something that's going to rise from the dead and keep coming back to haunt us. Tim Burgess was going to push his anti-panhandling legislation. He's actually been really aggressively pursuing a sort of a round of strategies that come out of the Downtown Seattle Association. He has put a bunch of last session, nobody paid any attention to this really, put a lot of unhelpful regulation that was aimed at the poverty hotels out on the Aurora Strip. I think that there are things that need to be done about that racket, but, you know, what he has done has been punitive and unhelpful there and does more to eliminate a desperately needed source of housing for poor people than to regulate it in a way that would promote fairness in that area. He is, you know, coming up with a round of new anti-panhandling legislation that is really just a sort of a bone for the Downtown Seattle Association to mitigate the panic that they're feeling around 20 to 25% downtown office vacancy rates and, you know, the collapse of the condo boom gold rush and the desperation that developers are feeling about the prospects of the downtown. And whenever you see that dynamic in the history of Seattle, what you get is this fear that is projected at the homeless, you know, where they are seen as the problem as opposed to, you know, the greed of the marketplace and the boom bust cycles of capitalism and, you know, the sort of, you know, dicey aspects of speculative capitalism and the risks that you run there. Instead, they, you know, they attack poor people and say that they're driving folks out of the downtown and are somehow responsible for downtown office vacancy rates, and so therefore we need to pass more laws against them. You know, I mean, this is the moment that we're in, and their core issue is we can't continue to just keep criminalizing poor people and legislating more and more excuses to harass them and levers of control to sort of, you know, sanitize the urban areas.
All right. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.